Colloquium. Monday, January 11th, with guest videographer Terry Simpson.
Thanks. It's really nice to be here, actually. So I don't often get a chance to talk about my work to people who are studying. I usually get to talk about it to people who are kind of a bachelor. But Scott asked me to come and talk a little bit about what I do and about my work. I was really pleased. This should be fun. I'm looking forward to it. Of course, I've got about 37 takes here, and we'll get through two of them probably. But I'm going to try to focus on basically two projects that I've worked on. One of them fairly recently, and one of them about 3 years ago. And I'll deal with that one first. It's called Frankenstein, the Modern Prometheus. It's an original production. A composer named Libby Larson wrote it. And this was in Minnesota, and Minnesota Opera Company produced it. They approached me about 10 months before the show went up, and they asked me if I was interested in creating a video segment, which is what Libby had in mind, was she wanted a little segment that would be called What the Monster Saw, you know, something that was like, would show on a large screen, would be a big film type thing that would suddenly show. She actually began her work on this piece about 3 years prior to that. This was the first thing that she wrote. It was an instrumental piece. A bunch of Cleveland Symphony did it, and a couple others around the country performed just that piece. It's like a 13-minute segment of it. Having dipped my feet into it, I also just started talking about what I also would like to see us do with the thing. The whole idea, her whole idea in approaching opera was let's make a modern opera first off. Let's do an original piece, and looking at Frankenstein, the things that intrigued her most about were the fact that here was an innocent child, and here was a struggle between science and intuition. Essentially, that was part of it. When it's a natural child, who is essentially, and she went back to the original source, she didn't go back to the original book, and her whole idea was here was a creature who was created, born as an innocent, an innocent as an adult, created, made, rejected by his father, tossed out into exile, into the woods. He learned everything he knew from animals. So going back to that source material, what I suggested, or what we started working with, was the idea that the monster, rather than being a big, kind of person, we started working with the idea that he'd be someone who actually learned what he did from the animals, basically. And we started working with like deer images and elk images quite a bit, and how he would move, and in effect his mannerisms, and also the fact that he probably wouldn't eat so well as he then. So I got them to hire Christian Swenson, who's actually from Seattle, to come out and play the monster, which is what we refer to him as. We did him shave his head, powdered his body, did a makeup job on him, and made him look pretty ethereal. And he's very active. Does anyone know Christian here? Anybody see his work? Probably one of the more talented people who works in Seattle. He does, his training is mime, dance, and he does a series of beast kinds of things with masks. He's about 6'6", weighs about 180 pounds, 160 pounds, something like that. Real thin, real long, very amazing mime. He's very amazing. What he's working on right now on his own is sounds, similar to Bobby McFerrin, only a lot more physical, a lot more doo-woppy physical kind of stuff, what he does. And moves them into movement. Anyway, back to the story, to the Frankenstein story. What we started from that, and what I wanted to work with specifically in it was, we were going to work with video. And my interest in it was, well, how can we use the source material? How can we look at it, and how can we justify something that looks different from video images, which are kind of ugly, which I work in all the time, but it's like, what can we do to make the images not have that kind of hot feel, that hot live TV feel? And so what I started to work with was the idea that this monster had two different eyes from two different bodies, and that they probably saw it differently. One was nearsighted, one was farsighted. Gave me an excuse to shoot the whole thing that we shot with, sometimes with two cameras, and sometimes we did it in the edit. So that whatever he sees, there's always two of the items. One of them's also, one is red, one is blue. One, you know, towards those tint, towards those colors. So it was this sort of justification in the role or in the material that you see that would lead me to an aesthetic that was pleasing to what I wanted to play with. And also, once I took that basis, it developed, it develops a life of its own, because you develop the capability that whenever the monster sees something, whenever he's intense, his vision coalesces, so you lose the double image. And so you can work in and out of it all the time. The first thing that I'd like to show here is about 40 minutes into the show. It's a 90-minute opera, real shorty in the opera world. What has happened to this point is that we had a creation sequence, which was the first video sequence. And what I mean by video sequence is, in other words, my work is involved with video that plays an important part in a three-dimensional space. The reason that I work in theater is because I work in three-dimensional spaces. I'm always resistant to people who ask me to, make me a video piece that will play, and then we'll let the dancers and singers take a break. You know, it's like, well, okay, but why don't we integrate the two? And so I think what my work is about is about integration of multiple disciplines. And a lot of them are disciplines that aren't usually being used in theater, are not often used in theater up to this point. Although in the future, they will completely. One of my whole approaches to doing this opera, one of my understandings was, the world of opera needs to find a way to reach a younger audience. You know, it needs to find, right now its audience is eight. Anybody an opera fan before I start? Great! Okay, I won't cast aspersions on it, but basically, opera, as far as I'm concerned, it has tended to be so, what's the word, don't say the word,
formal.
There you go, all of those. Yeah, it's so formal, expensive is true too. But the reason I'm not a great lover of that kind of singing, but the reason that I enjoy getting involved with opera is because my training in theater, if you think about what opera is a coalescence of music, dance, you know, singing, acting, visuals, all of that stuff, design, all of that stuff is in the roots of it. You know, in other words, so anything that you do in there is not necessarily experimental because somebody's done it. You know, you're in the same realm. You know, even though people don't know quite how to deal with a video guy in opera yet, you know, they don't quite deal with it well. The work translates because they're used to taking a great, you know, Wagner used the entire space of an opera house. Most people, you know, 100 years ago they were doing that. It's not like a new deal, you know. and I'm very comfortable working in that. What was I going to do with that? I don't know. I think I should show the work. Let me just say this. One of the struggles that I have in my work is that you're not going to see the work. And I think that that's something, I hate to take these opportunities to just preach, but in terms of your understanding of media and your understanding of this stuff, one thing that's real important, particularly if you're ever on a grants panel, you see my work on that, is to understand that you are not seeing someone's work when they make a presentation like this. What you're seeing is some sort of capturing of that work. And I'm going to try to explain it enough to have you pull it out. But essentially, my work happens on these two pieces in a three-dimensional theater with a lot of other people helping out. What you're going to see is actually a video documentation of the full stage on this screen. Okay. And what you'll see here is the what happens on the What the Monster Saw screen. Okay, so this is the video quality. It's basically broadcast quality video that played on the central screen whenever the monster was in the room. Besides that work, and I hate to talk this much without showing something. I apologize, but besides that work. What you'll see in the very beginning is work between these two gentlemen who are downstage on the pit cover, basically. And what we did with the story of it was we said, how come there's video in the 19th century? And we said, well, that's really weird. You know, how can we justify that? Well, okay, we got a $75,000 grant from Dayton Hudson to include a significant video component in an opera, and so there's video in an opera. But the givens of that is like, okay, what do we do with this story to justify? We can't just have cameras around and all these guys are running around the ship, which if any of you remember this or have read the story, how many people have read the book? A few, good. It's basically the parentheses of the book is the scientist who's doing an exploration of, he's trying to find his way through to China through the Arctic, and he gets stuck in the ice. And while he's stuck in the ice, this scientist on a dog sled comes by, and he's on near death. He brings him aboard. The scientists, they bring the help over 4 or 5 days. The captain of the ship makes some statement one time where he goes, oh God, this is worth it, even if we all perish for the love of science. My gosh. And the other guy looks at him and says, you're a fool, let me tell you my story. So he tells him the story, and the way the story is recorded is a really nice 19th century technique. This sea captain is writing the story in a series of letters to his sister. And of course there's no mail that's going to come out into the frozen Arctic, so he is pretty much assuming that he's leaving these letters on board the boat and someone's going to find them dead next spring and they're going to send them off to his sister. So there's that kind of feel to the thing. Well, what we did with the story, given that, was when we started looking at it, was we said, okay, the kernel of the story is, here's this scientist who creates a creature we can't deal with. Okay, so what we did with the story was we said the story takes place on this 8 foot by 20 foot opera stage, or this 8 foot by 20 foot hallway in a psychiatrist's sanatorium. And what he's got is a biogenetic engineer who is freaking out because he can't deal with the fact that he's right on the verge of a discovery that it changes the way people will reproduce and become people. He's right on the verge. He can't deal with it. He goes into a psychosis. The psychiatrist says, oh gosh, I'm going to look at this and figure out what's with this guy who's talked into himself. Okay? So what we do then is the entire rest of the stage, which is upstage at that moment, is for the 19th century stuff, which is where this guy's going into with the psychosis. He's suddenly going into a romantic time, and science must be really a whole lot better, you know. And boom, he's Dr. Frankenstein, who who is creating a monster in a way that hasn't been done before and is right on the verge of making life in a way that will affect humanity forever. So what we dealt with was we ended up with two singers who were Frankenstein. We had a 19th and a 20th century Frankenstein. What you'll see in the very opening here what I was working with was a scientist is shooting across the front of this pit cover area. He's actually recording this psychotic guy on videotape because he knows if he can break this guy, he will become he can write it up, and they'll want to see the films and stuff of it. PBS will probably underwrite it and stuff. So the whole thing that we did with that was there are black and white monitors roughly like this in relationship to the opera audience, and they're turned on their side, okay? Just to alter things a little bit. It gives it a little different aspect, and it's kind of interesting. What you'll see on this screen, actually in the middle of it, occasionally you'll see that image, which is the image that would be seen on the sides here, okay? Which are the black and white images, only these two guys, okay? Near the end, which is, or later on, I start to mix the images that they shoot, and we play back and forth with the two victors, call them the victors, that was their first name, 19th and 20th century guy. Okay, and that's where we'll pick up. The place this has happened is the monster has killed the brother of the 19th century victor, and Victor is in deep anguish about it, and you'll see two victors actually in deep anguish, the 19th and the 20th century guy. He says, let me meet the monster I have made, and then we have the entrance of the monster. Okay, is that probably plenty of talking. Let's just do this. I have to cue this deck up just a touch. Black and white image you see at the sides here in the audience. And I've superimposed it over the whole stage. Thank you. says, I know it's in. going to interrupt that right there. Whoa. you get the idea? Anybody get the idea? The actors actually on stage, which this one keeps coming back to, you know, sort of the screen that's there, which is about 12 foot large. And the other actors, they're there. There's not, I hate to say there's not a lot they're doing because they're the actors, but it's like their presence told the story to the theater audience as much as the work, the video work that was up on the screen. I fought real hard to get them to be on stage and to actually to do stuff because there were connections that they need to make. Essentially, the story of what's going on in this piece, and we're not going to see the whole thing because it's 13 minutes and I haven't talked like a lot. But the story of it is that essentially what's happening is there's like this thought transfer between Victor and the monster, which is the pictures. And in the pictures, he's basically saying, look, here's my life's been really hell. You're my father. You're responsible for me. I was tossed out. I've been raised by the animals. I've suddenly grown to realize I have no family. I have none like me to mate with or to hang out with, basically. I'm not of the animal kingdom, and I'm not of the world. You owe me something. And his whole thesis is sort of like sex on the brain. You know, he wants a mate. And by the end of the, or by the middle of this section, Victor says, well, okay, and so he brings, so the monster brings a body, lays it on the table, and he says, bring her to life. You know, and this is actually a character that was hung for the murder of the kid that he murdered. So she's dead, she was hung, she got blamed for the monster's murdering the kid, and brings him in and says, you know, bring her back to life, make her real, make her my wife, and we'll go off and leave her forever, and go off to the Arctic where no one will be. And so Victor says, okay, that sounds fair. I owe you that one. And then actually the next place I want to take up with it is Victor obviously goes through a lot of problems with this, and it's the two Victors who go through problems with it. It's like, well, gee whiz, what if they have little monsters? And then what do we do? You know, here we have this creature that we created that we suddenly realized was a big mistake, and now we're possibly creating a whole population of them. Well, what are we going to do with that? Where I'll start you here is there's a duet. If you can change that to the other direction. There's a the two Victors are one who's busily at work on this woman, and the other one is in terrible moral quandary. Sings about it, and they decide, I'm going to destroy her. I'm not going to make you a mate. And this sort of ticks off the monster. And so the next sequence you'll see after that is a video sequence that has to do with the destruction and leads up to the murder of. There's a lot of murders in this stuff. I mean, you're all pretty used to that, but this will show you a bit some of the ways that we did the murders in this stuff. The other thing that I should say about my work is that. It's technical hell. There's a lot of prep involved in it, a lot of work. For this stuff, we actually 6 months before we went into rehearsals with the opera actors, we actually hired a bunch of local music comedy actors and spent 6 days in a warehouse with them working out exactly what we wanted to have happen in the video. A couple months later, we came back and we had the opera actors, and we actually shot this material. And then they all flew off to where they work on other stuff. And then they came back like 6 weeks later for actual rehearsal of the whole opera. And that gave me that 6 weeks to edit the thing, the video stuff that accompanies all of this. Once again, let me go back to the black and white images that you saw was a live mix. In other words, that was a two-camera live feed. What I was, and let me explain this a little bit. What I was playing with, I actually also designed a 14 slide projector addition to this. In other words, whenever, and you can't see them on the video because it can never pick up, you know, this nitty of light. But essentially for the audience, for the audience, whenever anything was happening, it was usually added into by projections that were all over the hangings that were all around. So it, rather than just being this one hot screen in the middle of blackness, it was really one hot screen and then images like this would be projected onto, that would fill the space out quite a bit. And also, in much the same way that I edited with, that I edited different images in, I also used the visual feel of editing for the slides. In other words, during that laugh sequence where everybody was laughing at him, well, it was also like all around the large screen in the middle, everywhere there would be faces laughing at him in a sequence. So, like I said, my focus is always full three dimensions of space. Okay? Let me just show this one. Maybe what about the one? That the audience saw was very stark, and it was the world that Victor and the scientist cronies would see. You know, in other words, it was the underpinnings of it. It was a cold world, and what the monster saw when he saw these wonderful 19th century boardrooms, you know, he saw complete images, and there are places in the opera in which both the monster and Victor are looking at the same thing. And we're seeing what the monster sees, which has backgrounds, you know, has all this kind of Victorian stuff, and we're seeing what Victor sees, and it's just like the skeleton of that. It's just, he just sees the scientific black and white. So let me continue with this a little farther. Thank you. basically when the monster looks up from her, it's like, at the moment that she dies, it's like his vision is totally focused, and then at the moment he looks up, it's like the whole room starts to spin away from him. It's what I was going for. And what we did actually with each of the murders was that on stage we stylized them such that what happened, and you can sort of tell, but what happened was all during this section, she is, if you were in the audience, and this is where three dimensions helps a lot, you would see that she's being like drawn towards this couch and he's being drawn towards this couch. As on the video, we see him approaching her and she's sitting there. It's more of a reality. And so that, but what happens in the actual instant of the murder that we see on the screen, he's actually just standing there holding this locket, which has significance. We work that into it back there. But he actually just holds it, and she just sits on the couch in live theater, and she just sits there, and then she goes, and collapses. You know, so it's just like this. We were working with levels of memory. You know, it's just like, rather than a duplication of what's going on, it's like, well, what's really going on, because all these people are singing about this stuff, is for a moment we're playing with his remembered event. You know, it's already happened, and now it's a remembered event, you know, for a moment. We play back and forth with that. That's one of the things that I enjoy about working with this kind of stuff, because that's what it is. I don't think we'll get to it. No, we won't. But I actually did a piece here at Mini Hall a couple of years ago, in which it was, I worked with two choreographers, and what we did was to these Bach cello solos, we did, they had done this really intimate duet, and then what I taped was really close-ups of that, and then performance, they weren't a duet, it was a single person. You know, and the dynamic that it was just, and they would keep switching off, like one person would be in her part. And the whole duet was all contact. It was all, it was a very slow duet. It happened within a space about this big. And it was all about the connections between the two of them. And so then what we had in the live moment was, I actually should just play this one. Is that okay?
Yeah.
So it's going to be hard to see because once again it happens in a live theater and this is going to be a video documentation. But essentially what it sets up is a dynamic that has a lot to do for me with loss, longing, and remembering and things like that. But let me just show you that.
We have about 5 minutes plus another 5 for questions.
Okay, we'll just look at just the least little bit of this. This was a very stylized piece. This is a gray 12-by-12-foot border that she's in. This is a 12-foot screen up above her. That's how, this is a tape of the stage. That's all you're going to see.
Thank you.
basically, my feeling about theater is that we should be creating theater that belongs in a theater, because it can only be appreciated in a three-dimensional space. I hate going to the theater and seeing work that ought to be on television. I hate going to the theater and seeing work that ought to be on film. I think if people would quit showing that kind of work, then I think more people would be coming to the theater, because once you go there, you experience something that you wouldn't otherwise experience, because of the three dimensions and the fact that you've got 200, 300, 400, 500 people all undergoing the same sort of thing. I think theater would stay very alive. That's why I end up being totally broke instead of doing film and video work, which is, because essentially all of this work is very expensive to do, it costs a lot of money, and you're stuck with the economics of the fact that you're only going to be able to show it to 200 or 300 or 400 people, and I don't know why we're in this business. Because the only place there is money is some place where you're going to show it to potentially 3 or 4 or 20 million. I got tons more to do. I don't always do video work. The other piece that I wanted to show you was one in which I'm a writer-director, and I was working with a choreographer, and we decided not to use video in the piece because we were self-producing, we didn't have the money, and instead it was written for 2 actors, 6 dancers, and 15 slide projectors. All the projections were on moving bodies and foam core and different things in the environment rather than on screens. We're not screens. So that's kind of a summation of some of my words.
Starting point for questions for Terry?
Yeah. You're talking about expense. As far as technology goes, is that expense you somehow need to use, or is it just going to be deployed?
Well, more better stuff, videos definitely become cheaper. I mean, this little thing here is about $1,000 high-end camera, and it would do what, a $20,000 camera of 8 years ago did. And it has a nice picture, and it's putting a lot of this technology into people's hands. It's still, to do it right, essentially for the opera, my own budget for that, anyone want to hear this stuff? I mean, one of the reasons that I think university people should, I wish I'd known what the hell the economics of it were when I was going to college, because I might not have done it. But essentially, you need to know, can I get on the pulpit again for just a moment? You need to know that the only way you're going to make a living is if somehow you connect your work, if somehow you wear a lot of different hats. You're going to have to work industrials. How many people in here are actors? How many people directors? Okay. How many people designers? Okay. Essentially, you're going to have to do everything, particularly if you have a commitment to live theater. How many people are involved in live theater, primarily, if you think that way? How many people see themselves on television? Industrials? Okay. My feeling is over the next 20, 30 years, you're going to have to do all of it. You're going to have to, unless you're extremely fortunate, if you want to make a living if you want to be able to buy a house in Seattle, I can't do that right now. A lot of people I know can't. In fact, 70% of the people in Seattle can't buy the house they live on if they were buying it right now. So the realities are that there's not much money to be made off of grants. That's a terrible process. And you're going to have to, and there are communities that are very well integrated. There are Minneapolis. That I would work in industrial house, I also do lighting for television and industrial. and I would go work operas, and I would go work the most weird avant-garde video things, and I would see the same group of people. It's like, yeah, that's great. I mean, and I would see those people understanding that, oh, these are the talented people, we should hire them rather than actors who decide to be working industrial development, we should hire the best people. You know? And as actors, you're gonna have to do it if you wanna make a real living. Anyway, that was a long, long answer to a short question. So, anyone else? You don't wanna get me started.
Well, Terry, we thank you for sharing. And also to Pete from IMS, who helped with all the complicated setup. Thank you,
yes.
Pete, for being here.